It's after 1 o'clock, and I'm going to call the state government finance meeting to order. Representative Uglem, have you had a chance to read the minutes for March 7th?
I did, Mr. Chair, and they're completely acceptable, so I move the minutes.
Representative Uglem moves the minutes for March 7th. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
So moved. Okay, on the agenda today, we have updates from the Secretary of State, Steve Simon. So if we ask you, Mr. Simon, to come forward. Okay, welcome to the committee. Can you state your name for the record?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State.
Thank you. Go ahead and proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I've been asked to give kind of an update and a summary of legislation that you passed last year, and thank you for it, that helped local governments purchase new elections equipment. It's a real success story, and I think all of you should know that you own a big part of this. This would not have happened, obviously, without this legislation, and it was much needed. So I want to thank all of you for that support over the last couple of years, specifically last year. I just wanted to, I think you have a handout in your packet, and I don't want to just read from it or repeat from it, but I thought it would be helpful to just talk a little bit about the history of this issue. It really started with the 2000 presidential election in Florida, where everyone agreed, whether you were for Bush or Gore or Nader or anyone else, that Florida was a mess. And it did not show this country in its best light, just in terms of the election administration process. We all remember the visions of the people holding up the hanging chads to the light, and it was kind of an embarrassment. And so on a broad bipartisan basis in 2002, Congress passed the Help America Vote Act, also known as HAVA, which, among other things, bought new elections equipment for America. Basically, everyone in America got new stuff. And in Minnesota, the money came through, most of it in about the 04, 05, 06 range. That's when most of our cities, townships, and counties bought their elections equipment. Our office doesn't own any elections equipment. We never have. I don't think we ever will. So this is about the stuff that local governments need and use in order to administer elections. So there was a lot of money that came through, but that money has gone away. And the useful life of these machines, even the vendors will tell you, is about a decade, maybe a little more if you stretch it. And we were getting to the point around 2015, 2016, where we had already reached the useful life length. And there was one report from the Brennan Center in New York that said that 43 states, including Minnesota, were going to be using elections equipment for the 2016 election that was at least 10 years old at the time. So we knew we needed to replace it. And so starting in 2015, we got together a working group, including folks from all four legislative caucuses here in the legislature, including representation from townships, cities, counties, and others. And we started talking about what we could do about it. Now, we never really aimed to have the legislature buy all equipment for everybody. That was unrealistic. We didn't think legislators would go for it. We were right. But what we were aiming for all along was some reasonably generous match, so that local governments, principally counties, but also cities and townships, could make the decision about whether they could put up most of the money if the state kicked in some reasonable kickstart so that they could get this new elections equipment. The entire problem, if the state had bought everything for everybody, which was never the goal, but if that were the case, it would be about $28 million. But we knew that wasn't going to be the case. So in the end, we requested about $14 million, which would have been about half. What we got in the end was $7 million, which is still very generous, to replace this elections equipment. And I want to specifically call out Representative O'Driscoll in the House and Senator Kiffmeyer in the Senate, who were the authors of that legislation and worked with our office on it. And the bottom line was it was up to a 50-50 match for most kinds of equipment. And just so we know what we're talking about, just to step back a little bit, every precinct basically has two pieces of equipment. One is the actual ballot counter that you're familiar with if you go into your polling place that either you or an election judge feeds that ballot into. And the second one, required by HAVA, it's not a state mandate, it's a federal mandate, is every precinct in America basically has to have assistive voting equipment, meaning equipment that can accommodate voters with disabilities. So every precinct has those two things, basically, with some narrow exceptions. And you're talking about $10,000, give or take, to replace that stuff, which is not cheap. And so it was a 50-50 match for all equipment except for e-poll books. Now, some places, Hennepin County and others, have taken the initiative to have e-poll books at the polling place, which is, in essence, an electronic version of that roster that you sign typically when you go into a polling place, saying you are who you say you are, you live where you say you live. And that's something that many people have taken to. That we decided to say up to a 75% match. So for everything else, up to 50, for those, up to 75. I should tell you there was a cost in staff time and resources for our office to administer this. We opted to absorb it. We didn't add a fiscal note. We just absorbed that cost. So none of this $7 million went to us at all, not one penny. We were just the pass-through, and so we've administered it, pursuant to your direction, of course, in getting it to the local government. So how did that work? We worked with the Department of Administration to draft a state contract. That's something that had been recommended to us because that's what was done in HAVA back 15 years ago or so. In other words, leverage the purchasing power of the state so that local governments can buy things more cheaply. And that's worked really well. So we worked for many months with the Department of Administration to negotiate that. And then there was an application process. Applications were due on December 15th. Between December 15th and January 19th of this year, our office reviewed the applications for completeness and then prepared grant contracts and award allocations. And we decided not to make this super complicated. All we did, and we consulted with the counties and the cities and the townships and, of course, with all of you on this, rather than come up with some weird or crazy or unique formula, we decided let's just take the number of precincts worth of counties that have applied, divide it by the amount of, or take the money, divided by the number of precincts worth, and that's it. And by sheer coincidence, the number that we came out with was $1,958 per precinct. I say by sheer coincidence, because Minnesota, of course, as everyone knows, was founded in 1858. And so the actual number per precinct is 1858. That's the number that makes it easy to remember. So every precinct from every county, and 85 out of the 87 did apply, every precinct gets that much, 1858 per precinct, which is a dent, which is a kickstart, and was enough to leverage almost all of these counties coming through with the money on their own end. So in the end, and this is in a report that we had to submit to the legislature already by statute, and it's in, I think, your materials today. We had 59 counties request about $5 million, I'm rounding here, $5.1 million in matching funds for electronic rosters, 97 requests for about $8.2 million in matching funds for the other kinds of equipment. Obviously, that's more requests than there was money, and it came out to $1,858 per precinct. Following the initial allocations, there were some jurisdictions that went back and said, wait, we'd like to change. We want our money to go not to this kind of equipment but to that kind of equipment. That's fine. The law contemplates that, so we've done the reallocations. Those requests were due February 8th, so there was the change totaled about $89,000 out of that $7 million. So not a lot, but there were a few people at the last minute that kind of changed their order, you might say, and that's fine. We were able to accommodate that. They're not getting any financial advantage from that. In terms of future benchmarks, basically, most of the equipment's going to be purchased between now and August of 2019, not 2018, 2019 they have to purchase it. You know, based on what I'm hearing from local elections administrators, the vast majority, as you might expect, are trying to purchase in time for the 2018 election, but not all. Some have said that they intend to wait until after the 2018 election. We just don't know. August 31st, 2019, in the law that you passed, says that unused funds, if any, must be returned to the Office of Secretary of State. Obviously, we're just the custodian. It doesn't go to us, meaning our budget, but we're the collectors of that money, and we would hand it over to the general fund. From September to December of 2019, there would be a possible second round of grants from any unused or returned funds. I don't anticipate any. I think everyone's going to get the money while the getting is good. So I anticipate zero, but the law that you passed says that if there are any unused funds, we can do a round two. I wouldn't bet on it. So June 30th, 2020 is when the unused second round of funds must be returned to the Office of Secretary of State, and, of course, we would turn that over to the general fund for your use. So that's really the sum and substance of the report. There was a formal report that we had to do pursuant to the law that you passed, and we've already given you that, and we've even updated and amended it since we had to give it to you. But that's really it. I just want to thank the many hands who worked on this, both parties, all four caucuses, people from all levels of government. You know, I understand. I served on this committee for many years, and you have a lot of demands on your time and on the resources that you're given within your target. And I really want to thank many people who worked on this. Representative Nash had a major hand in this as well, given some of his expertise. And there were others as well that I can't mention every person. But and Madam Chair, not the current Mr. Chair, but the person who officially chairs this committee, Representative Anderson, in this context, thank you as well for your support, ultimately, for this legislation. I think it's going to make and has already made a real difference in terms of making sure we have as secure a possible an election system. It's a big, big issue, and I think we've taken a big step. We take some pride, obviously, in Minnesota. We like to be on top 10 lists, and we have our well-earned Minnesota superiority complex. And you'll see that there's a great map there in your handout that shows only two states, us and Nevada, have taken the initiative to do what needs doing, which is getting out ahead of this thing, not waiting until stuff starts to fall apart, not waiting until you have delayed election results, questions about the integrity of the system, all the rest, got ahead of this and did the right thing early. And I think that's to be commended. That's not our graphic. That's a graphic from an outside think tank highlighting some of the challenges in this issue. So thank you for stepping up, and thank you for helping elections administrators everywhere in Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I'm happy to stand for questions, pushback, feedback, anything you have. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We do have some questions. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, thanks for being here today. I have a question that might actually lead to money coming back. I have two townships in my district that are literally their polling places on the same street, almost across the street from one another. They would like to combine, but they have, as they understand it, they're not allowed to combine. So maybe you could help us out, because they both have received some monies. They both would like to combine just from a duplication of effort. Can we work together maybe offline to figure out whether they can or can't? Because the two townships, quite honestly, they say, well, we'd like to just be in the same polling place and use the same equipment, and it might save everybody involved some money. So if we could figure that out offline, that would be great. And then, you know, Carver County always leads the way, being a great place, but, you know, also having the highest voting turnout. I always like to remind everyone of that.
That's right.
But they might actually return some cash. So yeah. Can we work on that?
Secretary Simon?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative Nash. Yes, absolutely. I think you sort of hinted at that earlier during one of our discussions. This is the most specific I've heard of. But, yes, I'm a big fan of that. I think there are two ways that all local jurisdictions can get out from under some of the high costs, even of this generous state match. One is combining polling places, and there are advantages and disadvantages to that, but it is done. I think it's going to increasingly be done. And another that's available to townships and small cities that have 400 or fewer registered voters, not people, but registered voters, they qualify, if they wish, they don't have to do it, to go mail only. And some of you probably represent townships that are in that category. We have over 50,000 people in Minnesota who vote in jurisdictions that don't have a polling place because they have elected, they have chosen to ditch polling places in favor of vote by mail only. And you're seeing more of that in response to a number of things, one of which is the cost of the equipment. So, but to your specific question, Representative Nash, yes, happy to work with you on ways that we can do that. The situation you described, it makes total sense for consolidation.
Representative Nash,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Just another quick question along those lines. This grant is obviously great, and it's much needed. Are there any concerns that come as a byproduct of upgrading election equipment or changing the way tabulations are transmitted, handled, or anything like that we should be addressing moving forward?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nash, I'm not quite sure. Are you getting at just sort of the sort of integrity of handling the results, that sort of thing? Well, yes. There's a big one, and you and I know, have discussed it offline. It's a big issue. I think everyone knows here, it's ripped from the headlines, this issue of possible interference in our election system, electronic interference in our system. And to me, I don't much care whether it's from a foreign government, a foreign organization, or the guy next door. This is increasingly a very, very important issue. I believe it's the most critical issue. I think it's the biggest challenge facing the integrity of our elections nationwide and in Minnesota is this very, very real threat. people seeking to undermine our system by seeking to intrude. And, you know, this is not new. This is not a government thing. This is not a Secretary of State thing. Any large or not so large entity, whether it's Home Depot, Target, Bank of America, Equifax, or the Minnesota Secretary of State's office, this is just a big deal for everyone. It takes on a greater importance and gets more coverage in the election context for all the obvious reasons. But I'm interested in looking forward and making sure that we have the commitment, which I know we do. There's no one in this room who isn't committed to making sure our system is as foolproof as it can be. So it knows no party or political allegiance. But it is, in part, a resource issue, and we're getting to the point now where there's some things we need to commit resources to. You know, we're working very closely, for example, with the Department of Homeland Security in Washington. About a year ago, a little over a year ago, some members might know, the Homeland Security declared the election system in this country to be critical infrastructure. And that's a term with meaning in federal law. Critical infrastructure is a designation that only applies to certain sectors. Before, a year ago, it had only applied to, I think, a dozen or so. It was like hospitals, defense installations, the power grid, the banking system, the things you might expect, kind of the main pillars of kind of national life. And that's a big deal. They don't do that lightly. And one of the things it means is we're entitled to extra help from Homeland Security. So they've been out here physically. They've been helping us, giving us best practices, doing scans, doing cyber hygiene, as they call it. And they very often come up with recommendations. You might, that seems natural, right? They come and they spend a day or two, or they do a bunch of exercises, and they say, we think here's the seven things you ought to do, or the three things you ought to do. Those things cost money. And sometimes it's just a question of certain software, sometimes it's certain hardware, but they're things that cost money. They aren't always in our budget. We've done our very best to find that money and just do less of other things. That's what you would expect us to do and everyone before your committee to do. Don't just come to us asking for money. Find the savings internally. Make the hard decisions. Defer things you wanted to do that maybe are wants, not needs. So we've done all of that. We believe we have. There's still, though, an extra bit to go. That we think it's under $100,000 to last us between now and November. And while every penny counts, it's the taxpayers' money, you know, in the grand scheme of things, we hope that might be something that this committee and others would consider. It's for hardware. It's for software. It's to make sure we can get through the November 2018 election in as good a shape as we possibly can. So.
Okay. Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Secretary. As our counties are updating their equipment, could you discuss any compatibility issues? Are there any compatibility issues out there?
Yes, there is one major compatibility issue.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm a little rusty. Mr. Chair and members and Representative Fenton, there's one major compatibility issue. Your county, of course, is at the forefront of this. I mentioned earlier, Mr. Chair and members, that there are two major pieces of equipment in every precinct. One is the ballot counter, and one is that piece of assistive voting technology for voters with a disability. In this industry of elections equipment, the machines can only talk to other machines of the same brand, the same vendor. So picture Apple and PC, for example, although it's not a great example because we know that you can do, you know, Microsoft stuff on Apple and vice versa. So vendor A's ballot counting machine can only talk to vendor A's assisted voting technology. You can't mix vendors, in other words. And we have a situation, unfortunately, now in Minnesota that requires a bill that's pending. I'll skip through all the technical part of it, but basically, in order to certify equipment for one particular vendor, to even make it eligible for certification in the state, we have to pass a bill that is before you or soon will be. It's been introduced. If we don't pass it, then there are a lot of counties, including Washington County, including Hennepin County, including many counties throughout the state, that won't be able to buy the replacement equipment for the assisted voting technology because it hasn't been certified yet. And the reason it hasn't been certified yet is because the law hasn't been passed. So there are a lot of counties, yours included, of course, that are in limbo and in need of having that legislation passed. And it simply would allow our office to even entertain certification. We can't even do that now. We can't put it through the paces until that bill is passed.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Secretary Simon. So when all of our counties purchased this equipment, they were actually purchasing equipment that was approved to be able to purchase. Was there any knowledge at the time that this would not be compatible with the disability or if they needed to upgrade to disability equipment?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, members, and Representative Fenton, no. I mean, the counties were, if I understand your question correctly, the counties did what they're supposed to do. They did their due diligence. They, I assume, as every county tends to do, they looked at all the vendors that were available, purchased the one that they wanted, either because it was the best based on price or on quality or whatever they wanted, they bought it, unaware at the time that they would be in the position they're in today, not even being able to purchase replacement equipment, even if they had the money, even if they had 100% of the money, they're unable to purchase what they need to purchase because that vendor's equipment can't be certified, and it can't be certified until this bill is passed. So it's a little bit circular.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one final question. So what happens if there is nothing if a bill is not passed to basically certify, what happens to all of the equipment that the counties have purchased with this grant money?
Secretary Simon?
Mr. Chair and Representative Fenton, the counties are in a real tough box because they can't use the new stuff they want to buy because it's not certified for use in Minnesota. That would be illegal. What they could do, what they would have to do, is try to get another cycle out of the stuff they have right now, which is aging, which is old, which is very old technology. It's sort of like, you know, your 2004 flip phone was great in 2004. It wouldn't be so great now necessarily. And so it's showing its age. They're showing the glitches, and they're in a box. They want to buy this. They have the money to buy it too because of what you did last year in this legislation and which leveraged funds from the counties and local governments. They want to buy it. They've got the pen and the checkbook out, but they can't because the stuff they need to buy, because they can't go with another vendor. They're stuck with vendor A in the one piece of equipment. That means they've got to buy vendor A's different kind of equipment, and they can't buy it because it hasn't been certified yet, and it can only be certified if this bill is passed.
Representative Fenton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No further questions.
Okay, next we have Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Secretary Simon. I'm thinking in terms of supply chain, and we all want the most modern, up-to-date, secure piece of equipment. Is there any issue with the manufacturing? And you know, if everybody's buying all these machines at the same time, is the supply there?
Secretary Simon.
Good question. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ward. Yeah, I think the supply is there. There are enough vendors. In Minnesota, we have three currently certified. There are other vendors in other states that sell similar products. If they come and seek certification, it's a two-step process in Minnesota. First, we won't even look under state law. This is law that the legislature has passed. A machine isn't even eligible. A vendor isn't even eligible to come to us and say we're seeking certification unless it's first been certified at the federal level. That two-step sort of belt and suspenders approach is not done in every state. So there's a federal organization called the Election Assistance Commission, which certifies elections equipment. Our requirement in statute is we won't even look at it until it's first gotten the EAC national certification. Then and only then will we have the vendor come in and do certification in our office. And we've tried to send out notices to all of you on this and other relevant committees when we have certification, if it's typically in the interim. But if you're in the neighborhood and wish, it's open to the public anyway. But you can always come in and look and see what we do. It's typically a 2 or 3 day process where we put machines and our election staff put machines through the paces, all sorts of scenarios and hypotheticals, and put it through real world conditions to see if it meets the test. So it's a two-step process. First, federal certification. Then and only then is it eligible. Then we do it. And if it's certified, then it can be sold in Minnesota. But there are other vendors that could come to us. There aren't only three nationwide. There are three that we've certified. There are several more nationwide that could. They haven't yet, but could come to us. So it's a great question, but I'm confident that the supply will be there.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ward?
Just one more question. I'm sensing that there's some concern about passing this bill. What's what are we waiting for? What do we need to do to make that happen?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ward. Well, I don't want to speak for those who are skeptics on the bill, but my understanding is there was maybe some confusion about whether the disability community supported this bill. I can tell you that disability community overwhelmingly does support that bill. We have a disability advisory council within our office that meets quarterly and has for years since I got there. And we had this machine before that group. So members of the various disability organizations around the state, and I'm including the Council for the Blind, the Minnesota Council on Disabilities, the Minnesota Council of Deaf, Deaf-Blind, and Hard of Hearing, the Minnesota Disability Law Center, those are just the ones that come to mind. And they got to touch and feel and try the machines, and they at least wholeheartedly support this bill. So I think there was some confusion, I'll put it charitably and call it confusion, about whether the disability community supported this bill, and they do. And that was my impression of what some of the holdup has been, like last year, for example.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just another clarification then. Where is the bill now, and what do we need to do to move it forward?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ward. I believe it was on the general register, so I think it's back in Representative O'Driscoll's committee, I believe, by operation of rule. And so I think that's where it is right now.
Thank you.
Ward. Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Simon, on the grant money, when is those dollars visible to local entities?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, now, basically. I mean, the checks have gone out, are going out. I think there's a little bit of money that hasn't gone out yet, but substantially all the money has gone out to the counties and the cities and the townships right now.
Representative Quam.
So, in other words, the first dollars went out?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think I'm looking at my timeline here. They would have gone out, February and into this month. So pretty recently. Our aim, I should say, and your aim in passing this, because I know this came up when we were talking about the bill, was to get it done as early as possible so that most jurisdictions could, if they wanted to, buy stuff in time for 2018. And, of course, it's not just November. It's the August primary as well. A good idea to have the same machines in place for both. So getting it in time for August was a high priority, and most jurisdictions seem to have that in mind. So I would imagine they're going to be purchasing the equipment pretty quickly.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Secretary Simon. And, so that makes it more comfortable that there aren't a lot of people or shouldn't be anybody that spent grant money on stuff that wasn't, already certified. We've got old equipment, we're getting new equipment. Is there currently documentation for all contingencies if there's a malfunction or failure of equipment, so that there isn't any equipment that we have or will be ordering that we don't have a contingency if it fails?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, that's a great question. Some of you may remember who are around here that the legislature passed in 2015 a bill that required all counties to do a county sort of elections-related emergency planning process. And there's a report that each county has to fill out. It doesn't have to be some grand, manifesto. It doesn't have to be 100 pages. It could be 4 pages. And we've had reports of varying lengths. But in it, most counties have addressed that very thing. What happens if I would go even beyond just the equipment. What happens if there's a power outage in a polling place, in a big polling place even, with a lot of voters and there are lines? What do you do then? So that comes under the category of just emergency planning generally. It could be weather. It could be a power outage. It could be machine malfunctions. And that is left to an individual county-by-county determination, but they have to make a determination. So the law that you passed in 2015 says, in essence, which I think was the right call and the right approach, we're not going to, boss you around and tell you how to make those plans. We just want to know that you've made those plans in whatever way makes sense for your particular county. They write it up in a report. They file it with our office, and that's the system we have.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Chairman. So with the adaptive accessible equipment that generates and prints a ballot. What happens if that fails and it can't produce a ballot? Is it allowable by state law? Somebody takes out a piece of paper and sort of makes up a handwritten ballot. Is it similar to the procedure if you run out of ballots? If you can enlighten me on this, because I'm sure that this possibility is quite probable.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Quam, yes. No, that's a very fair question. So what happens if an assisted voting device goes out? Under the current scheme of things, it's a ballot marking device. You use a regular ballot, such as any voter would use, and this machine will mark the ballot for someone. But what if it doesn't, right? What if it malfunctions? What if it goes haywire? There are a few options, the most common of which is that under state law, it could be an election judge, it could be someone else in the polling place, could help that voter with a disability to mark the ballot. So that is done, obviously, very, very rarely, but you're right. You have to think about those things. What happens if the thing just doesn't work, it loses power, it runs out of a battery? That's typically what would happen.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. And so the final clarification, if one of these that actually generates prints, whether it's skinny, whether it's standard format, fails, they would then be going back to the normal procedure of assistive on a regular standard ballot.
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think so, yes. I think in most places that's the case.
Okay. Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Simon, regarding some of your comments about security, I think about going into the polling place, I sign in, and I get my ballot, I go fill it out, feed it through the machine. Is there any point in there where there's a security problem in terms of could it be hacked during that time, or is it something that happens after all the votes are done? Because I look at the machine, it's not connected to the Internet. These are questions I get all the time, and you hear about what's going on in the world and so forth. So at what point do we really have to be concerned about security and integrity of our voting?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer. That is the big question. That every state is wrestling with exactly that. As I've said, I think it is the number one threat to election integrity in this country and in this state is the possibility that someone will make mischief in an electronic way. As to the polling place, I am less concerned about the polling place than I am about other potential vulnerabilities. And the reason I am, and you all know this from experience, but it bears repeating and it answers your question, is the basics, the fundamental design of our system in Minnesota is very sound. For one, we are proudly old school in Minnesota. We are a pen and paper state. We're not like those 16 or 18 other states who I think have really rolled the dice here, who have touchscreen voting machines with no paper trail, no receipts. I mean, there has been, as long as I've been working in this building, alongside many of you, there has been an ironclad, bipartisan, almost unanimity in this legislature for always having a paper trail. No matter what the gadget, no matter what the machine, always have a paper trail, and we do. It's very old school, as you know. You just fill in that oval. It's very hard to hack paper, obviously. So it's just a pen and paper, and that's great. And, yes, it's right, Representative Detmer, that you feed or an election judge feeds that ballot into a machine, but under state law that cannot, shall not, must not be connected to the Internet. Afterwards, we have an encrypted system by which local governments report on an election night to our office. And even then, real human beings are actually talking to each other to make sure that the return that was submitted for this contest is really the one that was received on the other end. And even then, after that, under federal law, we have to keep the physical ballots for 2 years, almost 2 years, 22 months. So for 22 months, we've got to keep those ballots so people can touch and feel and see and look at the actual ballots. So I'm less concerned about the polling place. I can't say it could never happen. I think that would be irresponsible, just like the CEO of Target or Equifax or U.S. Bank can't say it will never happen. But I think it's less likely. My major concern has to do with the statewide voter registration system called SVRS. Mm-hmm. It's the database that is centralized in our office that was built in 2004. And again, like that 2004 flip phone, it was great in 2004. But it's been asked to do so much more since then. It's so much more complex and complicated. And that particular kind of database has been the subject of headlines. You may know that Minnesota was one of the 21 states. We have that confirmed by intelligence officials. We were one of the 21 states. It was targeted by elements, quote, acting at the behest of the Russian government, end quote. That was the exact word, because you don't hear behest too much in a sentence, so I remember it. Mm-hmm. Acting at the behest of the Russian government, that was what they told us last September in a briefing. The good news is we passed the test. We weren't hacked. In fact, there wasn't even an attempted hack. But the reason I bring it up, Representative Detmer, is two of those 21 states were not so lucky. In Arizona and in Illinois, in those two states, there was a breach, and it had to do with their equivalent of what we call SVRS, their statewide voter registration mm-hmm. system. So it's for that reason that I think, is the number one concern, and that over time we're going to need to do a major upgrade of that system. And that system, by the way, was built in 2004 with $5 million of federal money from the Help America Vote Act and somewhere over $1 million in state money from the general fund. So we think we can do it for far, far cheaper, and that's a different hearing and a different time. But I will tell you, we've costed it out over 4 years. It would be about $1.4 million over 4 years, not two. So about $700,000 a biennium. We think we can do it, rebuild it. This is not Minlars. Just want to make very clear. This is not Minlars. Minlars is a brand-new system. That's not what this is. It's like a sign on the outside of a building saying we're open during construction. It would never go down. It's not a new system. It's just recoding and refurbishing the existing system with no loss of service. It's not a new system at all. It's just redoing the existing one. So to your question, that's where I think the real vulnerability lies, or the biggest one at least, not as much in the polling place because of the fundamentals of our system, but I would be foolish and irresponsible to say it could never happen. I just think the chances are a lot less that something bad could happen in the polling place.
And Mr. Chair, just a quick follow-up. So then we've been talking about new equipment. Are we going to stay with that safe system of paper ballot and then county machine and that type of secure system that we already have? Are we going to stay with that?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Detmer, I think so. I mean, my read of you, and this goes back, 10 or 15 years, is there is really, as I said, an ironclad consensus here, regardless of party, that we are never going with the touchscreen paperless machines. I think that would be a huge headache. I can only imagine what those elections administrators went through this last election cycle with all the headlines. Here in Minnesota, we have those safeguards. I have not detected among any of you any appetite to deviate from that bipartisan longstanding agreement that no matter what the gadgets look like in 10 years, 20 years, we're always going to insist on good old-fashioned paper and a paper trail that you can touch and feel and see. No matter where the technology goes. But that's your decision, not mine.
Okay. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Secretary Simon. Well, so I was going to bring us back to cybersecurity, which Representative Detmer did, so I think I have all of my questions answered. You clearly stated that the SVRS is your biggest concern with regard to vulnerabilities, software, hardware, and that polling places aren't, and I would agree, having served as an election judge, and the comfort level, too, that you reiterated that here we are a paper state with a paper trail. This is a really good thing that gives most people a comfort level. But we count the number of people when they walk in, and we count the number of ballots that were used, not used, and didn't leave the polling places until everything was accounted for, so that's really good. I'm wondering if there are any other examples or concerns that you have with regard to vulnerabilities other than the SVRS.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pugh, let me think about that. I mean, the polling place, SVRS, those are two big ones. The only reason I'm hesitating is I want to be careful and not inadvertently provide a roadmap to someone who means to do us harm. I'm happy to maybe discuss it with you offline. I mean, I have some thoughts as to how I would answer that question, but this comes under the category, I hope you'll forgive me, of not wanting to perhaps advertise something that I believe, and more important than me, our IT folks believe could be a vulnerability. We think we have it covered, but I'd rather not name it. if that's okay.
Representative Pugh.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would look forward to having that conversation. That would be great. And also, I was looking at the recap of all of the counties and the number of precincts, and you know, my understanding is we have about 4,400 precincts in the state of Minnesota, thinking that a number of mine are very close together as well, so I'm just wondering if there might be an opportunity there to consolidate. But there's 422 that were granted equipment resources in Hennepin County, so I'm assuming when we meet I could confirm which of my precincts, I represent 16 of those. I don't know if all of them have received new equipment, so I'll look forward to finding that out as well. Thank you.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Secretary Simon. You and I may have had a couple of discussions on election-related matters over the years, but with that, I want to go back and maybe fill in the gaps on a couple of items that we've been speaking about today. I'd like to go back to the concept of the skinny ballot system, and you were talking about, with respect to Representative Quam's inquiries about, you know, what happens if those systems that were purchased, you know, they're just not going to be able to be certified because the legislature doesn't take action to allow that. You had said that, you know, the 2004 phone was great in 2004, but it maybe doesn't do so well in 2018. Can you tell me who a supplier might be for vintage equipment that those counties might end up having to procure parts for and from?
Secretary Simon?
Mr. Chair, thank you, and Representative O'Driscoll. Yes, actually, you may recall, I think it was before your committee, I might be mistaken, but before your committee, I believe it was last year, one county auditor, who happens to be the head of the Association for County Auditors, famously said that they were getting to the point where some of her colleagues were having to find spare parts on eBay.
I'm sorry, Representative Simon, Mr. Chair, what was that, Secretary Simon, on what?
On eBay,
thank you,
Representative O'Driscoll, because some of this equipment is not being serviced everywhere all the time anymore because it's obsolete. And just like many products that we bought in the late 90s, early 2000s, at some point some vendors say, it's so old we're going to stop servicing it and providing parts. They're out there, you know, in markets on eBay and other places. But, yeah, that's unfortunately what some county auditors have had to resort to. But, again, that's why, and this is apart from the assisted voting issue that Representative Fenton raised, that's why what you did last year, and you in particular, Representative O'Driscoll, and thank you, you were the mover of this in the House, and that's why it was so important. So,
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Secretary Simon. I don't want to ask you to speculate whether eBay or Craigslist might be the better provider for the counties on this, but I will ask you a question relative to how do we preserve the election equipment integrity when it's bought off of a system such as eBay or Craigslist, because it might not be in the possession of a bona fide elections county, city, township. How would a local, when they don't have the ability to have the equipment we're having trouble with, and they don't have a vendor anymore under contract that provides that and find themselves in this, how would we preserve election integrity with the replacement parts of the equipment?
Secretary Simon.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, it's certainly a risk, which is why what you did last year was so important and why, in my judgment, passing the bill to enable counties who are sort of stuck to buy the next generation of the assistive voting technology is equally as important. You really, as any of us know, for buying anything on eBay, it doesn't have to be elections equipment, you buy anything, you buy it as is, right? There's no warranty, at least that I know of, typically. It doesn't come with, you know, a service contract or anything like that. So anything you buy on eBay, I would imagine, or any online trading forum, you're taking a risk, and as are counties in this context.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Secretary Simon. If there were more vendors that were approved to be able to provide equipment in the state of Minnesota, I realize that you're probably not a market forecaster or an economist of sorts, but you might have some thoughts on would the cost of overall equipment purchases be higher or lower if there were more vendor options that were approved in the state of Minnesota for our local precincts and counties to be able to purchase?
Secretary Simon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Driscoll. There's no question it would have downward pressure on prices. No question. We're already seeing that. After HABA was passed, there was one vendor in particular, and I'm not knocking this vendor, it's just how the market was at that time, who had a huge market share in Minnesota. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's just that there weren't as many vendors at the time doing this kind of thing. Now there are several doing it, and the more that do it, the more price competition there is that counties and cities and townships can take advantage of, and we're already seeing that with this elections equipment. There's competition. It's driving the price down, not up, and every time we certify someone else, I would assume it's going to increase that tendency. It's going to help drive prices down, not up through price competition, which is good for taxpayers.
Follow up, Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Secretary Simon, in the $7 million grant that the legislature approved, not all of that was 100% dedicated to equipment replacement. Some of that was to e-poll books, and some of that was to equipment grants. Without having to go through a series of questions, maybe I'll just give you my first three questions that tie to this topic. Number one, could you review for the committee the breakdown of how much was for e-poll books, matching funds, how much was for equipment? And then second would be, do you have an average grant for equipments that went out to the counties? And then perhaps a cost on an average voter-assisted system for those counties who might not be able to purchase or get certification for their systems and would have to buy additional voter assisted equipment. And then finally, what kind of pressure would that place on the counties or those precincts who are hoping to get that grant money to replace other systems that are failing without having to go to their backup supplier, eBay and or Craigslist?
Members, we're running short on time, so we're going to have two more questions after this. But Secretary Simon, if you want to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, I'll try to answer all those. So we had $7 million that you appropriated. The requests were $13.3 million, and we knew that there would be more requests than money, right? What else is new, right, in this building and elsewhere? There are always more requests than there is money, so no different here. So the requests were, there were 59 entities, mostly but not all counties, 59 entities requested, I'm rounding here, $5.1 million in matching funds for electronic rosters, the e-poll books, and there were 97 jurisdictions that requested $8.2 million in matching funds for the optical scan precinct stuff, basically the other items as well. The number, and I think maybe you weren't here when I said this earlier, but the number is easy to remember because it's the year of Minnesota statehood, 1,858, believe it or not, 1858 per precinct that was allocated. So that's what it came down to, 1,858 per precinct.
Thank you.
Probably didn't answer all of those questions. I should have jotted them down. But
okay, we have just two more folks. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to kind of thank Representative Driscoll and the others that were involved with this. It's looks like it's really going well. I always looking at maps that look like this and look like Minnesota's doing well. And, you know, by 2019, we're going to be in good shape. I like your pledge and the comments about the paper. A couple years ago, I was involved, went up to Renville County, and there was a team on each side of the aisle and looking at the, because that was a recount year, and it was just super fascinating for me to see the ballots. And it's really hard for people just to write in a circle or something even still, but when you look at them. But I actually found one vote out of, we looked at thousands of ballots, and I was kind of proud. I found one vote that it was agreed upon that was different than had been decided. But that's how tight the elections are. I mean, I think that was an oddity. It might have been like five in the whole state or something that they found, or very few that year. But can you do anything, Secretary Simon, on Electoral College stuff, or is that outside your jurisdiction?
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lilly, that's probably for another hearing.
Mr. Chair, it's neat to see you in this role. We were lucky enough, those of us that were lucky enough to serve with him when he was a House member, if he actually knows and cares about elections, if you ever get a chance, go into his Secretary of State's office, and I'm sure it's still there, but upstairs, and when he had his office was here, he had literally a hanging Chad ballot box and a Ziploc bag full of the actual ballots, and you could just, it was actually a neat, I studied politics in college, but it was super neat to see it in real life, the hanging Chad. And you could just clearly see how it was trouble, where you'd have a paper and a person would punch it, and the Chads were literally hanging. Anyways, I just thought it was super fascinating. If you do get a chance to get in there, and I could just tell from your comments and answers to the questions that you know the issue, and instill trust in for us as citizens of Minnesota. But we're in difficult times. These questions are, it's scary, and it's good that we're asking these questions. So thank you.
Well, Representative Lilly, I want to thank you, too, because it's nice to know there's bipartisan agreement that we like red maps across the United States. Representative Anderson.
Ouch, but good.
Secretary Simon, if you'd be willing to stay, we have some testifiers. Carrie Allerman from the Minnesota Association of Townships. And after Ms. Allerman, we'll have Andy Logan from Dakota County Elections, if he would be ready.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Carrie Ann Allerman. I work for the Minnesota Association of Townships, but I am also an elected official from Harris Township. I am the township clerk up north in Itasca County. Minnesota Association of Townships actually represents 1,700 plus townships in the state of Minnesota, which equal out to be hundreds to thousands of people that we represent and we do elections for. As the clerk of Harris Township, I am actually the head election judge. So this is kind of near and dear to me, as I served as election judge in 2016 for the big presidential election, and now I have three elections coming up this year in Itasca County, one special elections and then the two coming up. Townships are the ultimate example of the local democracy. It's next week. We actually have our township meetings, our annual meetings, and we have our constituents set our maximum levies for us. I would like to express my appreciation for the partnership we actually have with the Secretary of State and his office. It is great to know as a head election judge and as I work with my county, Vicki Martin, that we have somewhere to go when we actually have questions and we have issues. It's really nice to be able to pick up the phone and actually talk to somebody. I would also like to thank you for the grant monies that have gone out. It has helped greatly up where I'm at, up in the Northland. And I know there's a lot of counties and townships throughout the state who really appreciate it. As the communications director for the Township Association, I have heard from quite a few townships that are grateful for the monies that have helped update our election equipment. I'm going to say that the new equipment is easier to move. I don't know how many of you have ever moved the old AutoMark election equipment, but I had to have my 18-year-old son help me load that thing into the car. It was him and my husband who loaded it because it was too heavy for me. And as many of our election judges are older, they cannot move it on their own. So the new election equipment, a lot of us in the townships have had the opportunity to go and try the equipment, and it's a lot easier to use. So I appreciate that. We have heard that there is still a need for some more additional funding, so I'm going to ask that we can look in that direction also for more additional funding, as some counties and some townships can't afford all of the new equipment. But I'd also like to thank you for this opportunity for letting me come and speak to you today.
Thank you, Mr. Allerman. Is there any questions? Seeing none, thank you.
I got easy.
Mr. Logan. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is Andy Logan. I am the elections director for Dakota County.
Thank you. Proceed.
I'm here to speak today as a member of the Minnesota Association of County Officials Elections Committee. Thank you very much for this opportunity. The voting equipment grant passed by the legislature last session has been a great benefit to Dakota County, enabling the county to deploy an electronic voting system to 118 of its 140 precincts, covering 95% of Dakota County's 250,000 registered voters. We didn't apply for the grant to replace our voting equipment because we replaced our voting equipment in 2015, and so it wasn't eligible for the grant. In July 2017, 12 of the large cities in Dakota County wrote a letter to County Manager Matt Smith asking the county to partner with it in the deployment, purchase, and use of an electronic poll book system. The county agreed, and we took the lead in applying for the grant funds and arranging for this purchase and deployment. In December, we applied for the grant, and in January, we were advised that we were awarded $260,000 towards a $645,000 poll book system purchase. We plan to purchase through the No-Ink system through the county or through the state's cooperative purchasing venture. We arranged a cost-sharing agreement to split the cost of the voting system 50-50 after the grant funds were applied with each of our cities, and that results in the county putting in $200,000 towards the purchase and all of the cities combined putting in another $200,000. This is the same model that we've used to purchase our voting equipment in 2015. So we'll be spending the spring and summer setting up our e-poll book system, training all our users, and practicing for Election Day. And we look forward to the improved efficiency, security, and service our voters will gain from this system. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Is there any questions? Well, thank you very much for your testimony. Well, if there's no other testimony here, we'll thank Secretary. Thank you, Secretary Simon. Do you have any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, just thank you for your time and attention. Appreciate it.
Right.
And for what you did last year.
Thank you very much. Next, we have from the interagency agreements and intra-agency transfer reports. So, Ms. Helen Roberts, would you come forward?
Mr. Chair, I'm here. But I was going to ask you, I can present the information from here, or if it's easier for the members, I can go up to the front.
The table's fine.
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, Chair Anderson had asked me to put together some information to review some issues that this committee discussed last session related to interagency and intra-agency transfers. I hope if I put my glasses on. And I'm going to focus just on some select agencies and examples within state government finance. So if you serve on other finance committees, some of what you see may be different with other agencies that I'm not familiar with. So you have some information in your packet, and I'm going to start out by just reviewing the laws that govern interagency agreements and intra-agency transfers. And to start with is the Constitution. And the Constitution clearly states that no money shall be paid out of the Treasury of the state except in pursuance of an appropriation by law. And the reason I start with that is just to bring it back to the power of the legislature to appropriate money. And when the legislature appropriates money to an agency for a particular program, that agency can only spend the money on the purposes authorized in the appropriation. So that's the power that you have as elected officials. But the legislature has also enacted some laws that provide the executive branch some limited authority to transfer powers, duties, and appropriations within specific requirements. And I'm going to quote now from a House research document that's called Executive Branch Transfer Authority that was done by Mark Shepard in July of 2010. And it's an excellent document if you have further interest in looking into executive branch transfer authority. But the brief points out that, and I think this will be familiar to this committee, that laws authorizing the executive to make transfers involve competing policy considerations, that laws granting transfer authority for the executive branch may give the executive branch tools for effective and efficient management, especially when the legislature isn't in session. However, when the legislature authorizes the executive branch to transfer a function or an appropriation, the legislature is then delegating its own authority to the executive branch, and it may be difficult for the legislature to ensure that the transfers that are made comply with your legislative intent. So there's that kind of tension between when you consider granting authority to make transfers.
Excuse me, Chair Anderson, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Roberts, I do think it might be helpful for members if we can have Mr. Holdquist get a copy of that report. We can disseminate it to the members. I think it would be interesting for us to kind of dig into, given everything that we're talking about, especially tonight. I think this would be helpful for members to get familiar with.
And then continuing on the first page with laws, there's been an existing law since 1993 that allows appropriation transfers. And so an agency in the executive or legislative or judicial branch is able to transfer funds between programs within the same funds if the agency first notifies the commissioner of MMB as to the type and intent of the transfer and the transfer is consistent with legislative intent. And then the commissioner of M&B also has to report these transfers to the Ways and Means Committee and Senate Finance Committee. And this transfer authority doesn't is not allowed for very specific appropriations for an item. What we know as riders, you know, if you say $100,000 is for this specific grant, that money cannot be transferred. So that's been existing law since 1993. Now, last session, in light of the discussions that primarily happened in this committee, there were two changes that were made in the state government finance bill. The first is the change you see under 15.0395, interagency agreements and intra-agency transfers. And you'll see there that there are some new reporting requirements that have been put in place that will first start in October of this year, where agencies have to report to the legislature on specific interagency agreements and also transfers that are over $100,000 in cumulative value. So you will be seeing in October of this year some more detailed information on the kind of transfers that are happening. Then on the second page, there was also a provision in the state government bill that was specific only to the appropriations that were made within that bill, so only to the agencies that we consider within this committee. And that says that an agency that received money in the state government finance bill may transfer appropriations for staff positions, salaries, and technology within the agency to meet its statutory obligations. And then that agency has to inform the chair of the committee on a quarterly basis about these transfers. And then the final law that I have noted is the joint exercise of powers. And you'll, just to tell you, this is relevant to the second part of the discussion, which is for interagency agreements. And this is the legal site that agencies use for those agreements. So the first part, real quickly, on intra-agency transfers. This is kind of a little bit dry, but to revisit what this committee did last year, I have I've copied two of the sections of appropriations for the Department of Revenue. The first one is from the 2015 session, and you'll see that that department only received two appropriations, one for tax system management and one for debt collection management. And again, this level of appropriation is the level of control that you as the legislature have. So in the 2017 session, this committee chose to appropriate at a much more detailed level. So you can see on the page that's entitled 2017 Session Appropriation Structure that instead of just one appropriation for tax system management, there's actually seven different appropriations, breaking it down into, for example, operation support, payment and return processing, et cetera. And then at the very bottom, you'll see under effective and efficient tax service, there was specifically for Department of Revenue authority given to transfer money from that particular line to the other appropriations and activities in that subdivision. And I would note that I think that was given specifically to revenue because this was a pretty major change for them in terms of going from two big appropriations to much more detailed. And then the following pages are the report from Department of Revenue going back to that Section 40 that I had noted before, that there's a specific requirement that if an agency is going to transfer money between appropriations that they have to report to the chair and the ranking minority member of the committee. And as far as I know, Revenue is the only one that submitted a report for the first quarter. I think we did just receive one for Department of Administration. And the second page, I apologize for this, is probably really hard to read. And if somebody wants to see the actual spreadsheet, I have copies on legal size. I'm shrinking it down to letter size wasn't very effective. But if you want to see an example of what that report looks like, you can see how the agency moved money around to make it easier for them to manage their budget. The next few pages start with a table that's entitled Table 25, Transfer Appropriations. I put this in here. This was part of a document I have in my files that's called the Budget Processes in the States. That's put out by the National Association of State Budget Officers. And given the discussion we had yesterday, I thought it might just, I'm not going to go through it, but might be of interest to members to see the variety of powers and approaches that different states have to, in this case, particularly to their transfer authority. But this document, if members are interested, covers the whole budget process. So if you're at all interested in how other states do things, it goes into a lot of detail, which I know you probably don't have time for now, but it's pretty interesting, so we could make that available, too.
Chair Anderson, do you have a question?
I do on this report, this piece. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Roberts, when I'm looking at this, can you just kind of walk us through this? Because tell us the difference between a budget agency versus an agency, or can you give us a little greater detail on that as we're, so we know what the key is in deciphering all of that?
Ms. Roberts?
I believe I can interpret that. I think since we, if I get it wrong, MMPA staff can correct me because I know that they're very involved with NASBO, that the code budget agency would be the equivalent of management of budget or a finance, overall finance agency. Governor would be obviously the governor, and an agency would be at the specific agency level. And then a control board, I'm not sure about. That's probably something that's specific to, not something we have in Minnesota, but that other states may have.
Chair Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Roberts. Do you suppose a control board is more like what our version of MMB would be?
I don't know that.
Ms. Roberts, if we could have Mr. Hudson come down or someone that could answer these questions?
Or Director Kelly, maybe.
Director Kelly, maybe. Please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, Margaret Kelly, Minnesota Management and Budget. And I would be happy to reach out to NASBO to find out what a control board, what this means and what states do have them and how they. I don't believe this is something we have in Minnesota. I think it's something where some states have a board that can make decisions outside of a state agency, but I'm just guessing here. So we're happy to get back to you.
Okay. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, and I should also, I don't think that Minnesota has a control board, but members know that we do have the Legislative Advisory Commission that in certain cases has the ability to review various requests and actions by the executive branch, but we'll find out more on what this is. So really that was it on the, I just used that one example for the intra-agency transfers, but as always, if members have an interest in any specific agency, I'm more than willing to do more research and more detailed research if you have a question on something else. I just wanted to give you, I think, what was the easiest example. Now, moving on to interagency transfers, they're using examples of three interagency agreements that this committee talked about in some detail last session, so we're revisiting those. And the first is the transfers to the governor's office for their legislative staff that do a variety of functions and represent the agencies both at the legislature and at the federal level. And so there are two different reports. The first one is from the budget system. So this is the information that would have been in front of the committee last year as you were making your decisions. And again, these are all transfers from the various agencies to the governor's office, and then they're deposited in a special revenue fund. And then the second page where it's entitled Transfers in Governor's Office. This is from the accounting system, not the budget system, so it shows the actual transfers in for 2018, and so you can see at the bottom the total is just over $2 million for fiscal year 18.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Roberts, why is there a difference in the amount when you're looking from the accounting, the BPAS system, to the accounting system?
Ms. Roberts?
Because it looks like we've got $1.2 million on the one side and then $2 million on the other.
Mr. Chair Anderson, I think the governor's office would probably have to respond directly, but I would just point out that the first number is a planning number that was before what was planned at the time the committee was considering budgets a year ago, but isn't an actual. The transfers from the SWIFT system are the actual transfers.
Is there anyone here from the governor's office?
Well, Mr. Chair, can Director Kelly offer some insight on that at all? Or?
Director Kelly?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Ms. Roberts is correct in that the first number comes out of our budget planning system, and it is an estimate or a plan as we're putting the budget together. The second number comes out of the accounting system and is, I would qualify by saying it's a preliminary actual. When we close the books, we will have the final actual number.
Chair Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Director Kelly, so do we, based upon this is at this month of March, what would be the total end amount based upon kind of this spend rate that we're looking at here?
Director Kelly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, what this shows you is how much has been transferred from agencies to the governor's office. Mm-hmm. It does not show you how much the governor's office has spent.
Chair Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director Kelly. So can I anticipate that there will be more transfers into the governor's office beyond the $2,600,000?
Director Kelly?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, the accounting system simply reports out what an agency has entered in for transactions. So to the extent that any agency is anticipating to do additional transfers, you will not see those in the accounting system until they are actually entered either as anticipated transfers so they can be budgeted against or until they're entered in as actual transfers that are completed.
Chair Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if this is a question for Director Kelly or if Ms. Roberts can ask this. On the date that these are recorded in the accounting system, did this just happen like January 1st, or is this a cumulative of the January, February, and now a little bit of March? Do we know?
Madam Chair, I didn't show it on this just to make it easier to read, but there is a column and a field that records the actual transfer date. And I think that most of them, not all of them, happened probably in August or sometime around that time. But I can get you that information. So every line on here has a specific date for when that happened.
Okay. And Mr. Chair and Director Kelly, has the governor's office in the this may be Ms. Roberts as well. Has the governor's office on the transfer in to their office, have they ever transferred out to return the funds that were unspent, or have they always remained with the governor's office?
Director Kelly?
And maybe Ms. Roberts knows, too.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I don't have that answer.
Madam Chair, in general, the money that has been transferred from agencies is deposited in a special revenue fund and does carry forward from year to year. But I do note on this spreadsheet, right about in the middle, you'll see a negative for the Human Services Department. So I can look into that further. I don't know the specifics of that, but it may have been some kind of adjustment back to the department.
Okay.
Chair Anderson?
I think that's it for now. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, members, there are just two more examples of similar transfers. And again, these are transfers that are using the joint powers legal authority to make the transfers. There may be other transfers even within MMB that have much more specific authority and are for a very specific purpose. But within MMB, there are transfers, again, largely from the cabinet-level agencies for the statewide executive recruiter. And the first one, again, is from the budget system, so following up on your previous question, you can see for fiscal year 18, the planning amount was $304,000. And then the second page will show you the actual transfers from 2018 are $346,766. And then the final example I have is the Office of Enterprise Sustainability within the Department of Administration. And I was, and I can check with MMB on this, I was unable to find the similar information in BPAS for this office, but do have the 2018 and 2017 transfers shown here. And I included 2 years for this office simply because it's only been in existence for 2 years, so it's a pretty short history to see. And, Mr. Chair, that is the information I prepared.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Roberts, are there any questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the curiosity I had is, along with what the chair was looking at, if whenever this is given and you don't have room for the dates, if there's a notation of the date range that these are within, so that we know if it's the last few months or the last calendar or budget year. The other thing is I'm very curious about what the balances of these accounts are, because I see that this just gives us an idea of some of the activity, but over the last 7 years, if there's been a million here, a million there, possibly these accounts have grown to, say, maybe the order of $10 million and could be used for some special program that there was an emergency request for. So those types of information I would find useful. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I'm happy to pull that together for you.
Chair Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If Director Kelly can come back, this is actually on the statewide executive recruiter, which is part of MMB's.
Okay. Director Kelly and Mr.
Chair, I phoned a friend for this one.
My question is, so I'm looking at the what was proposed for the statewide executive recruiter piece, and it was at 304, but the actual transfers in is 346. So can you talk to me about what changed, why the increase, and so forth?
Mr. Hudson.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Edwin Hudson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of Enterprise Human Capital. As mentioned earlier, the 304 number was a planning number that we had entered into BPAS, and then the second number, 34,000 difference, I think was the more, it was trued up. And to be honest with you, that is not the sum total of the budget. The sum total of my budget for executive recruiting is $478,000, because what you don't see here are two transfers in, one from MnDOT and the other one from Met Council. But to answer your question, it's just the difference between the planning portion and something that is a qualified actual. That was the difference.
Chair Anderson.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Hudson, remind me again, what was the dollar figure you guys gave to us last year on what this would be? Because I know we had some conversation about it. Has that changed from what you had proposed to us in the last budget cycle? Do you remember what your budget book numbers have? Or maybe Ms. Roberts, I don't know if you remember that at all.
Mr. Hudson, do you have that information?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I don't have that number in front of me, but I don't recall it changing.
Okay. Maybe if you could just verify for us and just get back, I think that would be helpful, and we'll double-check with Ms. Roberts when she gets a chance to take a look at that, too. But talk to me just a little bit more. So you're planning on 478 from the original plan of 304. What has that all entailed? What's going on? Can you talk to me a little bit more about that?
Well, the 478, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the 478 number that I just shared with you includes the billed amount. So when you talk about the 304 versus the 340 number, again, that's the difference of what was planned with regards to what was transferred in versus more qualified actual.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hudson, I'm just trying to figure out why it went from the planned amount of 304 to whatever your planned amount is for now. I think it's 478. So what is accounting for such an uptick from what the original planned amount was?
Mr. Hudson.
So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I can give you an example of how that number may have increased a little bit from what was originally planned. We attended a number of career fairs for not only lower-level positions, but also for executive-level positions, and even career fairs for our veterans. What we had originally planned for, there were a few other opportunities that we felt that we could not miss out on, that we wanted to have some presence in. So what originally was planned for, maybe a few more activities we conducted that we felt that gave us a little bit more marketing or branding opportunities to make a presence in. So that's an example, maybe a few more career fairs than what was originally planned.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you had my ears perked up when you said veterans. So what type of career fairs are you talking about, Commissioner?
Mr. Hudson.
Mr. Chairman and also members of the committees, this year we had a significant amount of activity with regards to our veterans. We identified all of our veterans here within the state, and we presented them with challenge coins. And we're also working with our veterans and other veteran organizations such as Yellow Ribbon and really focusing in on veterans so that we can increase our hiring rate of veterans. And so we're pretty proud of that effort. Again, it's internal with existing employees to provide them with promotional opportunities, and external to attract them to come to work here for us here at the state.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
And would you be able to, you know, provide us maybe with a listing of those types of activities and, you know, when these things occurred and so forth? That would help. I could share that with my committee, the Veterans Committee. And, you know, were these things advertised out? Or I think you said it was just internal. Could you kind of, you know, give us some information on that?
Sure.
Mr.
Chairman and members of the committee, I too am a veteran, so this is an area of concern for me.
Yeah.
And another example of perhaps what was planned versus what was actual is in our advertising budget. When we have these events, we want to get the word out. Our efforts aren't limited to those internal to the state. Our efforts also include those external to the state so that we can tell all of our veterans that the state of Minnesota is the place we want them to come to work.
Okay.
It's a place, an employer of choice. So that required us to do a little bit more advertising. And we would be happy to provide you and share with you a list of all of our activities, not as it relates just to veterans, but even other areas and other people groups who we had targeted. So we would be happy to provide that list to you.
And Mr. Chair, just a follow-up here. I think what I might have you do is, sir, just come into my Veterans Division and give a presentation, and we can schedule you a time to come in and give a presentation. Many veterans attend my division, and also next Monday is Vets on the Hill Day.
Yes.
So it would be a great time. I know there will be buses coming from all over the state. So my committee administrator will give you some dates to maybe have come in and give us a briefing. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hudson, I share Chair Detmer's sentiment on this. I would like a top-to-bottom accounting of how the money went. If you can explain what you were anticipating the 304, what numbers went into the 304, and then what the actual spend was getting up to the what you're anticipating doing of the 478. I'd kind of like to see how you have it broken down for those costs. I think it would be helpful for us to know, because this is kind of a bigger issue on the whole transfer piece, and I'd like to have a little bit more delineation on the budget numbers for that. So if you could do that, that would be really helpful. And you can just give it to Mr. Hultquist, and he'll make sure the entire committee gets access to it, too.
Okay. Representative Uglem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Mr. Hudson, I guess I'm interested, too, particularly with the career fairs. Maybe you could shed a little light on some of this. For instance, where do most of these career fairs take place? Where have you gone to these events?
Mr. Chairman and members of our committee, pardon me, we've had over this particular fiscal year, we've had nearly 40 different career fairs all over the state of Minnesota. We've targeted what we call lead-in events, where we have gone out and worked with, say, the veterans, or worked with those perhaps of the Asian American community, Native American community, African American community, Hispanic community. And what we have done is we set aside some time to work with them to do maybe resume prep, and then to invite commissioners out. And the commissioners acted as advocates for their agency and made themselves available to tell perhaps veterans what I do or what we do in our agency. At DHS, this is what our objectives are, and this is what we do. We would like for you to come and work for us should you have any skills that you would see that would complement our efforts. So these are events where we went out and we basically had commissioners collectively working together to recruit from various populations just by telling them what we do.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglem, follow up.
So these career fairs are pretty much limited to the state of Minnesota then, or they have been limited to the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman and members of our committee, our efforts have been limited to the state of Minnesota. Now, mind you, this budget, we have a three-person staff that this budget comes out of. So this budget for us is kind of a shoestring budget with all of our efforts. We'd like to do much more than what we've done, but we have amazing results just with what we've done, and I'd like to just kind of talk to you and give you some numbers with just to demonstrate some of the success that we've had. Just since March 17, to December 17, we had approximately 541 contacts. 541 contacts. Of that number, we had 407 of them who were referred out to different agencies or different hiring managers. We interviewed, of that number, 106, and we extended offers to 52 of them. So you would see that our interview to offer rate is 49%. And we have strained the staff of three to get those extraordinary results on the budget that we have. And so this is an effort that we're pretty proud of. We're proud of our work with veterans, and we're proud of the numbers across the board. If you look at our numbers since 2015, if you look at the numbers, our recruiting efforts have significantly improved from 2015 to 2018. I can be happy to share that with you.
Representative, you can follow up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So you say, Mr. Hudson, during that period of time, you've recruited 52 individuals that have gotten jobs at different agencies and everything else. So roughly about $8,000 individual in cost, or I guess really I'd have to ask you, do you feel that these expenditures are in line with private sector recruiting agencies?
Mr. Hudson.
Mr. Chairman and members of our committee, the private sector, and having come from the private sector, have over 20 years in the private sector, and I'm amazed that we're able to do the work that we're able to do with the budget we have. The private sector has an extraordinary amount of resources that just isn't available to us. And not only that, they can extend their efforts outside of a state and target different colleges, go to different other states, and bring in people internationally less known outside of their state. We don't have the ability, the resources, or the funding to even come close to their efforts, but I'm pretty proud of that. Now, with regards to the numbers that you quoted there, yes, our interview-to-hire rate is about 49% with our contacts. But what we've done is we've created a repository of talent that we can always call on. So if I have a need for perhaps, let's say, a chief financial officer, I can now go to this repository of talent, and I can use that to help fill future positions, not just in my agency, but again, since this is a collaborative effort, we can do that throughout the state. So it does more than just give us individuals who we might hire at that time. It also gives us a repository of applicants, qualified applicants we can call upon should we have any openings in the future.
One further question, Mr. Chair, and then I'll end. Well, Mr. Hudson, that repository of talent, isn't it a fair thing to say that that degrades rather quickly in a marketplace where we have almost full employment? That repository of talent can change rather rapidly and evaporate rather rapidly, too, in this marketplace, can it?
Mr. Hudson.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that's absolutely correct. Currently, we're at 3.1% unemployment here in our state. And that is full employment. And we can't compete, perhaps, even like some of the companies and even other cities and other local jurisdictions here in Minnesota. It's difficult for us to compete. So that repository is always changing. It's dwindling. It really is. So we have to keep these efforts. We have to refresh these efforts.
Okay. Thank you.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was doing some calculations on some other things. Can you remind me again, is the 52 that have been hired, is that for 2018 or is that going dating back to 2015?
Mr. Chairman and members of our committee, this is our efforts from last year, fiscal year 17.
Okay, so 52 for the 478. Is that correct then?
Mr. Hudson?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I'm sorry, could you repeat the question, please?
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm looking at the numbers right, so that's 52 people hired out of the office budget of 478. Is that right?
Mr. Hudson.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the number 541, that's just from our efforts from March 2017 mm-hmm. to December 2017. Those numbers that I gave you is just from that window, just from that period of time. And that's where we got the 52 hires, just in that particular window of time.
Chair Anderson?
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then you said that that amount is 541?
Mr. Hudson?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, yes. We had, again, 541 initial contacts, 407 referrals out to hiring managers. We interviewed 106. Of those 106 who were interviewed, we extended offers to 52 of them, and we hired 52 of them.
Chair Anderson.
And Mr. Chair, last question, too. So out of your office budget, how much goes just towards personnel costs and things like that?
Mr. Hudson.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, out of this budget that I have here, we have a staff of 3, 2 recruiters and 1 manager.
Chair Anderson?
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Hudson, and how much are you spending for the 2 recruiters and the 1 office manager?
Mr. Hudson.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I can provide you the breakdown of the budget. We can do that. I don't have that in front of me right now.
Sure. Thank you.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just curious, probably to Ms. Roberts, do we have a breakdown on this for a minute as far as the transfers and so forth?
Ms. Roberts?
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, certainly I can run reports that would show transfers both to and from minute, but I think if you're interested in more of the enterprise fund for minute that provides those provides IT services to state agencies, I'm not sure that they would be reflected as transfers.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That answers my question.
Okay, thank you. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'm a little late to the game here to just ask a clarifying question if we're discussing the budget of the statewide recruiter or interagency agreements, because I would have some questions about some of the things, but I thought the spirit of today was more around interagency agreements. But if we're going to ask questions, I'd love to hear. I know you've had some successes in raising the amount of people we've hired that are women, people of color, veterans. Are you prepared to answer that question around some of the successes your office has seen and the number of people we've brought in to work for our state that, and what that's looked like?
Mr. Hudson.
Mr. Chairman and members of our committee, thank you for the opportunity. I am so proud of our team here in SER and also our recruiters in the agencies, and I'd be happy to speak to that number and share those numbers with you here just now. If you look at our racial ethnic minority recruiting efforts, in 2015, 9.3% was our representation. Today, in 2018, we have a 12.6% representation. If you look at our employees with disabilities, 2015, it was 5.8%. Here in 2018, it's 6.9%. If you look at our female representation, in 2015, it was 49.8%. Today, 2018, is 50%. If you look at our veterans, it's 8% in 2015. Today, we've slipped a little bit at 7.8%, but we're doubling our efforts, and my commitment is to get that number back up. Again, if you look at our leadership, and we're talking about the top 1,000 positions in the state, starting at grade 18M and above, if you break that down, we've had significant improvement, too, and I can go through the numbers the same if you'd like for me to do that.
Representative Olson.
I think that's satisfactory. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Detmer.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hudson, I know when you come into my committee, you can have more statistics ready for us. And could you, those 52 hires, are you able to tell me or tell the committee how many of them were veterans?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I don't have that breakdown yet, but I'll be happy to tell you that. Thank you for the invitation to come. We'll be happy to have that number for you.
Thank you.
Representative Detmer?
Thank you.
Is there any other questions? Okay, I don't see any. The committee is going to recess. Excuse me, Chair Anderson.
I was just nervous you were going to adjourn us, and okay. I wanted to remind you to recess.
I would.
Okay. Our committee is going to recess to the call of the chair, so I would assume we're going to be getting emails on that. And I want to thank you, and before I recess, I would like to thank the staff up here and Chair Anderson for this opportunity and for the help that I've received. So, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Do we anticipate we will come right after session, pretty immediately after?
I'm going to refer that question to Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Olson. No, I think that we'll have a little bit of a lead time. I haven't decided how much, probably about 30 to 45 minutes, perhaps as long as an hour. It just depends upon a couple of different things. So, it should give you enough time to get a little bit of something to eat, but not enough time to go off campus, if that makes sense. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, we are in recess to the call of the chair.